Ken McLeod, and welcome to this 15-part series on mind training, recorded in Santa Fe. This series touches on a variety of practices and principles regarding mind training, ranging from making adversity the path of awakening and taking and sending, to the four kayas and five forces in daily life. Before we start, I need to mention that this series was originally recorded on audio cassette, because it comes from a retreat I gave some time ago. Therefore, you may notice the sound to be of a lower quality than some of the other podcasts. And now, part one of mind training. Great sources of power and strength in the Buddhist tradition, my mind, is the emphasis on lineage. In the Kagyu tradition, the lineage prayer, which is part of the preliminary practices, has 43 or 44 teachers in it. So it's quite a long list now. And it goes back to Saraha. It's around the 3rd century of the Common Era. And the emphasis in lineage has created some interesting anomalies in the Buddhist tradition. In the Tibetan tradition, the inevitable gaps and historical gaps were usually accounted for by certain individuals having extraordinarily long lives, several hundred years in a couple of cases. The Zen tradition took quite a different approach. They just made up a bunch of names to fill in. Recently, I had occasion to attend a talk by a Burmese teacher who was trained in a tradition which doesn't have any formal meditation practice. It's totally mindfulness in your life. She's very solid. But someone gave me a reference to her lineage, and it's a small tradition of monks who live in the jungles of Burma. They actually trace their lineage right back to Buddha Shakyamuni, very explicitly. And the importance of lineage is that not only is it a guarantor, if you wish, of the validity of the teachings, they've been passed from generation, from teacher to student, generation after generation, but every one of those teachers, do I need, and this is just for Kathleen. Yeah. Do I need to? Everybody can hear me? Good. It induces a sort of artificial quality. Oh, okay. I see. That's right. Try again. Oh, that was what was messing it up yesterday. That's why it wasn't working, because I used the wrong one. Too many things here. How is this? Is it working? Good. Okay. each one of these teachers has used this practice for their own spiritual awakening. So, and realistically speaking, each one of them makes a bit of contribution to it, because it's not something that is theoretical. It is something alive that they have used themselves. And the importance of lineage then is a way of ensuring that the very life of the teachings passes from generation to generation. So I want to spend a few minutes just acquainting you with some of the many names in the lineage prayer. Now, I'm in no way a Buddhist scholar, and there are many, many people who know really who all of these people are, far more detail than I do. The prayer starts off with Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. And here's one of those little anomalies that I was talking about. Go straight to Maitreya. Now, Maitreya hasn't yet appeared. He's the Buddha of the future. Right now, he's hanging out in the Tushita heavens, waiting for his time, just as Shakyamuni did before him. However, the Indian master Asanga, many of you may know the story, it's in my book, about how Asanga meditated in a cave for many years, and praying to see Maitreya, and nothing ever appeared, so he walked out and came across this person who was had a feather which he'd dip in water and sprinkle against this cliff. And he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, the cliff is blocking the sun from getting my house, so I'm washing it away." I thought, oh, this person's got great perseverance. I've only been praying to see Maitreya for 3 years. I better go back and try some more. And he goes through several incidents like this, and eventually he has this vision or comes across this mangy dog and tries to heal the sores in the dog with his own tongue. And this last act of compassion clears away his obscurations. He finds himself looking at the feet of Maitreya. And so that's how the connection is made between Buddha Shakyamuni through Maitreya to Asanga. And then Asanga and Vasubandhu, I think, were brothers. Now, there's another important piece here. The Mahayana tradition in Tibet, anyway, had two main lineages. One is called the lineage of profound meaning, and the other is the lineage of vast action. The profound meaning came through Manjusri and Nagarjuna, and vast action came through Maitreya and Asanga. And the lineage of profound meaning focused principally on understanding how things are. And so you get all of Nagarjuna's exposition of emptiness and all of those dialectics. The tradition of vast action emphasized living awake and in presence. That's why it's called the lineage of vast action. And that comes through Asanga. And so this teaching is primarily in that lineage. And then it goes through a whole list of Indian masters, down to Dharmakirti, who lived, as far as we can tell, in Indonesia. And Atisha journeyed to Indonesia by boat, which was a very dangerous undertaking in those days. And uh, received the mind training teachings from him. And Tisha, in the way that I was describing yesterday, came to Tibet, and his principal student was Dromtun Rinpoche, who was a layperson, actually, like us. And from there it went into the monastic tradition, Potala Shara, and to Chekawa, who wrote the 7 points of mind training. And then it follows the Kadampa tradition, which is one of the four original lineages in Tibet. And comes into the Shangpa tradition with Khunga Chokdrup, which is the last line on page 5 there. It then follows the Shangpa tradition, which was the lineage of my teacher, Kala Rinpoche, another very significant name in that is Taranatha, who is a brilliant scholar and extraordinary historian, as well as a wonderful writer about practice. Many of the texts that we studied in the 3-year retreat were written by Taranatha. I didn't say it last night. Well, I'll take your word for it. The first one is Drowa, because that's what Tara is, not a... Oh, Drowi Gompo. Drowi Gompo is Taranatha. Just have to remember the Sanskrit, not as Lord or protector, that's Gompo, and Tara is Droma, so Drowi Gompo. Now, the Shangpa tradition, for various political reasons we don't need to go into, became it was basically suppressed, and there was a very, very thin line of transmission. Which, interestingly enough, included the heads of several other lineages. So you come down to Trinle Shingta was a Drukpa Khaju lineage holder. Tsewang Norbu was a Nyingmapa lineage holder. Sidhu Tenpa Nyingje is the 10th Siddha Rinpoche, who's the Kamakaju lineage holder, and so forth. Down to Lodru Tai, who is the author of this text. And this was another person whose text we studied a lot in the 3-year retreat. Lodru Tai lived in the 19th century and did a tremendous amount to gather rare lineages which were in danger of being lost, and put them together in these huge collections and preserved them. Kachup Dorje was the 15th Karmapa. Shiwa Nyingpo, Pema Wangchuk, and Chenze Odzer were all very important teachers in eastern Tibet in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Norbu Dundrup was the teacher of Kala Rinpoche, his primary teacher. And Rongjung Kunchap is the actual name of Kala Rinpoche, my own teacher. I received this teaching primarily from Kala Rinpoche, but also from a Drukpa Lama. He was actually the first person who gave it. This line of teaching to me. I was in Delhi, and it was murderously hot. And the Canadian High Commissioner said, head of the Drupa Khadju is in town. Why don't you go and visit him? So I went through this crazy motorized rickshaw drive through regions of Delhi. I had no idea where I was. And by the time I got there, I had a splitting headache. I was dead from the heat, dying of thirst. So the only question I had for him was, what do you do when you're suffering? What he said was, you take in the suffering of others and give out your own happiness. I had a very difficult time relating to the instruction at that point. But I've also received it from teachings from Dajun Rinpoche, a Sakya Lama who lived in Seattle for many years. We studied this deeply in retreat, many other teachers. So that's to give you some idea of the historical framework for this lineage. Any questions? Two other small points. The line to dismiss and dispel, which occurs in lineage prayer, dismiss is to get rid, means to get rid of attachment to an identity or a self-image, popularly known as ego clinging, but I don't like to use that translation anymore. And dispel is to dispel the power of reactive emotions. If any of you have any questions about any of the prayers at any time, please feel free to bring them up, because I'm quite happy to explain them to the best of my ability. Yes. They are usually translated as relative bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta or absolute bodhicitta. I prefer to translate them as awakening mind for what is ultimately true and awakening mind for what is apparently true. Okay? But they're usually translated as relative and ultimate or relative and absolute. Okay. Any other questions? Now this morning, I'm going to plunge straight in. As I said earlier, yes, Pat.
One question,
yes. What does that mean in practice? Okay, yes, well, good point. Put a shorthand, you know, it's murderous. Awakening mind for what is ultimately true. What is ultimately true? All experience is empty. So to hold that in mind is that the easiest way to do it is to regard everything as a dream. We're going right into that instruction. And awakening to what is apparently true essentially means compassion. So it means to hold emptiness and compassion in your experience all the time. So thank you for bringing that out. Now, as I said earlier, the essence of the Mahayana is compassion and emptiness. Mind training, or we are studying the Mahayana tradition of mind training, which basically means we're studying compassion and emptiness. The emphasis in our work is going to be on the compassion aspect, but this work
takes place on the ground of emptiness. So our first period of meditation will be concerned with this. And there are four instructions. And you'll find these four instructions on page, actually it's five instructions, on page 36 in the booklet. Look at all experience as a dream. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. Even the remedy releases naturally. The essence of the path rests in the basis of all experience. And then, for going about the day, in daily life, be a child of illusion. This first instruction, look at all experience as a dream. The first piece here is to understand a little bit about the nature of experience. What do you experience? That's the starting point. That's what most of us would say at the back of the book. Is that what you actually experience? Any particular color? Brownish? Okay. Anything else? Yeah. So, this is the first step. From the color and the shape and many, many other associations which come down to us, you know, through the process of growing up, we infer, back of book, but color and shape are a little bit closer. Let's continue. What do you experience? That's another layer of inference. You don't even know that there's anything back there. So you've started to think. Go back to what you experience. Yes. Okay. That's another piece. Because there isn't just color and shape here. There is also the looking or seeing. Right? Now, can you see? Can you experience seeing without an object? Can you experience a visual object without seeing? These are very deep questions I want an answer. Pardon? Oh no, it's in your mind. It's not a visual object then.
No.
We're talking about seeing right now.
Yeah,
you can't. You can't experience a visual object without seeing, and you can't see without there being a visual object. So, what's the relationship between seeing and the object in terms of experience? Yeah, you can't separate. So what we experience is seeing color shape. Now we have the big question. Where does that seeing take place? Ah, can't find it. Anybody else? In my brain? Gee, pardon? Well, I asked the question.
That's not fair.
Absolutely fair. Where does the seeing take place? Yeah, it's when. Where? Where is here? Gee, Elizabeth, I don't think there's enough room in this room for the two of us. Where does it take place? In the looking? Where's the looking? Nowhere? Well, I'd just ask where the mind was then. So that wouldn't get you anywhere. Several people sort of figured that one out. That's why they weren't saying in the mind. Yeah. Yeah. Get that one cleared up right away. Where does the seeing take place? Ah, the intersection between what and what? Yeah. Okay, so it gets rather difficult to say, doesn't it? Okay, let's go a little further. Okay, should we try that again? Make sure everybody has this. Okay, so where did the seeing come from? That's more of a description of process. Where did it actually come from? There's an experience that arose, right? There was an experience that arose. Where did that experience arise from? Anybody? No, nowhere? Okay. So now we've got two down. It doesn't come from anywhere. It isn't anywhere. Let's try one more. Where does it go? Do I have your seeing on my lap? Well, I don't want it. Here, take it back. Your seeing got onto my lap? Okay, so where is it now? Oh. Where did it go? Pardon? So, what do you usually say about something that doesn't come from anywhere, isn't anywhere, and doesn't go anywhere? We usually go a bit further than that, don't we? It doesn't exist. Yet, there it is. This is the nature of experience. And when you look at it just as experience, it takes on a somewhat dreamlike quality, doesn't it? This is what it means to say, regard everything as a dream. Regard what you experience, the experiencing itself as a dream. You don't go around saying, I'm real and everything around me is a dream. That's not what it means. The experiencing itself. Now, what happens when you do that? Things open up, don't they? If someone gets upset with you, what happens? What? Okay. What if you fall in love with somebody? Basically, yes. People get quite good at working with anger as being a dream, but as soon as they fall in love, they're gone. Much harder for people to work. But it's actually the same thing. Okay. Now, regard everything that you experience as a dream. That's the first line. What experience is the dream? Yes. What experience is the dream? Look. What do you see? No thing. Anybody else? Is it actually no thing in the sense of empty space? No. There is this knowing quality there as well. Okay. This is what the second line means. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. And examine... Did I use the word examine? I did, okay. Examine does not mean think about. It does not mean analyze. It means to look right at. You might say scrutinize. Just to look. Look very, very carefully. When we do this, as you become more adept with this, you find yourself looking at nothing. And what most people have difficulty with is not seeing nothing. We can all do that. But is maintaining attention in seeing nothing. That's much harder. And one of the purposes of meditation practice is to develop the capacity of attention so that you can rest in the seeing of nothing and not fall into distraction or dullness. So that's the second line. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. So you look. First you think of it, you regard everything as a dream. You look at what experiences the dream. You see nothing. Then what happens? None of you have done this before? Yeah, after the panic, what happens? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes something happens before it disappears. Yes, there's a calmness, and then what happens? Obviously, everybody's meditation experience is much better than mine. I'll tell you what happens with me. There I am, I look, I think. I go, oh, everything's empty. Ah, there's nothing here. Now, those kinds of thoughts arise. Right? No, it's not. It's a thought. Okay. Those kinds of thoughts rise. Does this happen to anybody else? Am I just all alone here? Oh, okay. Now, this is where the third line comes in. The remedy itself releases naturally. Because, you know, this is what we're talking about. Everything's empty, no good or bad in emptiness, etc. But these are just thoughts. And the instruction is, look right at the thought and see what it is, in the same way we looked at the experience of thinking, of seeing. And what happens when you do that? Yeah. Poof. And that's what it means. That's what the line means. Even the remedy releases naturally. That is, when you direct attention right into it, what is it? It releases naturally. You don't have to do anything else. You don't have to push it away or try not to be distracted. Just go. And you return to resting in seeing no thing. Okay? Yes. You can observe that you're thinking and just watch the thoughts parade across. This is a more awake quality, a more active quality, where you're looking right into the thought. Well, experientially, it's the difference between watching people go by you and looking right into their eyes. Okay? And that, you know, if you watch people go by you, they just go by you. You look right into their eyes, different things start happening. You follow? Well, just try doing it. Don't worry about investigating. Just try doing it. And then you just look right at it. What is it? Not what it's about. What is it? Yeah, as experience. What is it? There it is. It arises right at it. It's there. And then you find that that quality of looking dissipates, and another thought will arise, you know, oh, this is nice. Look right at that. It's that looking quality that is the characteristic of wakefulness. Follow? Yes. Through this you will come to know what that means. Now, these three instructions describe what is known in the Tibetan tradition as examining meditation, examining practice. That is, regard all experiences, dreams, examine the nature of unborn awareness, even the remedy is released naturally, just what we've described. Through this, you develop the capacity to rest with stability in looking. And that's what the fourth line describes what you do. The essence of the path rests in the basis of all experience. In one description of how ordinary or of ordinary experience is that you have the five consciousnesses associated with each of the senses. So you have the consciousness of seeing, the consciousness of hearing, consciousness of touch, consciousness of taste, consciousness of smell. You also have the sixth, consciousness of thought. I'm thinking something. When we rest in meditation, the activity of those six consciousnesses dies down. We find ourselves initially resting in the seventh consciousness, which is called the emotional mind. It's called the emotional mind because this is where the sense of I resides. And so you'll sit very peacefully in practice, and there'll be a sense of I'm here. Now, there's not a lot of reactivity at this level, because the mind's pretty quiet. But it's very much oriented around a sense of self. And any objects that arise are immediately appraised as attractive, aversive, or indifferent. Through the instruction of looking at experience, you actually get the mind to rest even more deeply. And you find yourself resting in the what's called the eighth consciousness, which is called the basis of everything consciousness, or the basis of experience consciousness. The subjective experience of this is empty, clear mind. It is frequently mistaken for enlightenment. Because everything's open, very clear, the mind's totally at rest. However, as soon as there is any movement in mind, the sense of I or object arises along with attraction, aversion, and indifference. As Dajun Rinpoche explained to me, the basis of everything consciousness is like ice. By practicing in this way, with the mind very awake and looking, so you have that active attention, and you are looking into experience and at rest at the same time, and that's what's very important here, is that stability quality and that looking quality together. You rest in the eighth consciousness, the basis of everything consciousness, and it melts. Its structural integrity dissolves. Now you experience mind as empty, clear, and immediate. It's a very alive, dynamic quality to it. Now when experience arises, there is no preference, there is no judgment, there is no sense of I or separation. And that's why it says the essence of the path rests in the basis of everything. And this basis of everything isn't the basis of everything consciousness. It's the basis of everything. This is this, pardon? Unceasing. Now, the way that you cultivate that ability is to be awake and present at the same time. And you'll find when you do this that you be able to set the mind, be totally awake and clear, look and be seeing nothing and resting there. And then the quality of attention will dissipate a bit. At that point, what most people do is to try to hold on to what was there before. Deadly. Doesn't work at all. Relax completely at that point. And then reset. And when it dissipates again, relax. And then reset.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.